welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate overlooked, ignored, derided, and just plain hated contributions to pop culture. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is the technology journalist and podcaster of all things nerdy, Andy Inutko. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
So, this is going to be an interesting one. We actually had an episode recently talking about a real-life person, talking about Napoleon. This is an episode where we're going to talk about a fictional person, which is, I think, a first for the show. So, tell us what you've come to talk about. Tell us why this character is maligned and why you think that that's wrong.
Well, it's all happened on Twitter, where I guess you and Merlin Mann were talking about this sort of thing. That, gee, maybe it might be time to have an episode in which someone defends Reed Richards. But for heaven's sakes, who is going to defend Reed Richards as a character? And Merlin and I probably had a conversation about that at some point. So he said, "Oh yes, you got to get Andy. And yeah, I was all over it because Reed Richards for me is that definition of a maligned character, and. I guess it goes too far to say that it offends me that there's so many people that that have such a low opinion of this character. But what really kind of ticks me off about it is that it doesn't have the tenor of I hate the stories that have been told by this character. I hate the things this character has done. This character is just a bad person and fundamentally unlikable, like as if he's Scrooge in the first 10 minutes of a Christmas Carol. It always seems to be that there, for absolutely no reason, it seems as though 7 or 8 years ago, there started to be this meme about Reed Richards is useless and Reed Richards is a jerk. Oftentimes accompanied by, there was a single panel from an issue from John Byrne's run in the 1980s, one of the greatest runs of Fantastic Four ever, where Sue Storm Richards had been manipulated by the Psycho Man, who has that really wonderful, like, Jack Kirby designed box that has size of a phone book and just has three big buttons: fear, hate. And so basically was manipulating her and just turning her into this persona called Malice. That's just nothing but pure hate. And she was just mopping the floor with everybody. And Reed Richards figured out that the only way to release this machine's hold over her, the hate's hold over, is just get her so worked up that just whatever it would cause, like, an interference of emotion. And so instead of, like, fighting her and pleading her, "Sue, come on, I'm your husband, these are your children, he's your kid, and they're your brother, can't do this." And suddenly he just realized that, okay, if I just start saying, "Oh, I'm sorry, are you still here? I'm sorry, I didn't notice you because you're just so totally useless and everything." And then she's getting madder and madder, and then the crescendo of this is that he just slaps. I said, "Shut up, slap."
Have seen that panel.
And so there's that one panel saying, "Yeah, see, he's an abuser," and this sort of thing. I think that mostly that was done. That panel is quoted as a joke, but that and other stuff tends to dominate this conversation. So when this meme starts to take hold that Reed Richards is not a good person, he's this absent-minded professor, he's a terrible husband, he's a terrible father, he almost got his girlfriend and his best friend and his girlfriend's brother killed with this reckless and irresponsible space flight, and then keeps manipulating them into this life of superheroes in which they're basically lab assistants and sometimes lab rats. And I rarely seem to hear someone who doesn't like that character, who professes a dislike for the character, that seems to be responding to actual things in the comic, as opposed to they haven't read a whole lot of these books, but they've seen the memes, they've seen the conversation, and if everybody seems to think that he's terrible and useless, then there's no smoke without fire. And on top of that, there's just so much. You have these characters that are around for 30 or 40 years, and I'm fascinated by the maintenance of these DC and Marvel characters, where you can certainly have writers who have what will later be recognized as landmark runs, almost defining or redefining runs on these characters. But nonetheless, you can't, if you come on board as the new writer of Fantastic Four, you can't come on board because I've always wanted to write police procedural dramas. And I've had this idea of the story in my back pocket, but I can adapt it for Fantastic Four. We'll make Ben into all the parts that I had written that were for the grizzled captain. That's going to be for Ben. And when you have the gumshoe part is going to be for Sue. And then we'll have like the superintendent part. We'll give that to Reed. You can't do that. You have to create new stories that nonetheless are both A, ability to teach us some new things about these characters, but also are consistent with what's going on for 20 or 30 or 40 years. And we're not talking about having to recite stick to continuity slavishly, but at some point, you know what these characters can or cannot do. You know that if Sue Storm were to kill somebody, there would have to be a really good there would have to be specific reasons why she wound up doing that. You can't just simply have her someone who, for expediency, gives someone a brain aneurysm or just pops their skull off because it's the fastest thing to do. That's when you realize that, okay, someone had this really cool scene that they've always wanted to write for some character, and now they're simply having Sue Storm do it. And so in my mind, and I'm not saying what should or shouldn't be done with this character or what Marvel should or should not be doing, it seems as though Reed Richards was written as a pretty consistent character. Sometimes he does good things. Sometimes he does things that are frustrating. And a few times he's done things that were completely questionable. But they were definitely had a connection to the original version of that character as conceived by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. And there's some good runs and then there's some bad runs. But it just seems like 8 or 9 years ago, my perception is that it's like the first team of writers came aboard that was informed by the meme and decided, okay, I'm going to start writing Reed Richards as though he's a total jerk. So the version of I can sum it down into one single issue that is the core of Reed Richards, everything that I absolutely love about that character. So it's that famous issue late in John Byrne's run where Sue is pregnant with their second child, who was conceived in the negative zone. And because of science fiction, the fact that the baby was conceived in this alternate dimension means that there's all kinds of unusual energies and she's about to give birth, but it's clear that there's the unusual radiation in her body is mixing with the unusual negative zone stuff. And it looks like it's certain that she's going to lose the baby. And it looks like it's almost certain that she's going to die in childbirth too. And Reed has brought in the experts, every medical superhuman medical expert that's in the family has been advising on this, including Bruce Banner. And he suddenly realized, okay, there's one guy that we haven't really talked to yet. And that is Otto Octavius, Dr. Octopus, and he's a psychopath and he's in jail. And they're all saying, oh, God, for God's sakes, you can't, spring him out of jail for this. And so he feels as though, well, this is the only
he has. Of course he does. Yeah.
He's a biologist and he goes to the institute where he's locked up and using really great humanistic techniques, he lays out the case not to Dr. Octopus, but to Otto Octavius, the brilliant scientist and biologist who has not been able to do science or biology because he's been being a supervillain all this time, and said, Octavius, not saying Dr. Octopus, Octavius, if you have a chance here to do some good, I come to you because you're the only medical expert who can save my wife and save my baby. And it breaks through to him and he's, it would be great to do some good. Yes, I'll come with you. And then of course it's a comic book. So while they're flying back to the hospital in the flying, that wonderful flying bathtub, they pass by one of the Daily Bugle's anti-Spider-Man billboards. And of course, Octavius just snaps and turns back into Dr. Octopus. And so they start fighting and it's a really good fight. This is why comic books are so great. There's another reason why Reed Richards is so great. You have a man who's made out of rubber and you can twist him into any shape, and he can fight by adapting to just about anything. And when you hit him, he turns into all kinds of other cool shapes. It's just a beautiful thing when you're when you got an artist who really digs into the possibilities of that. And at the, he finally manages to at least pause the fight because he realizes that Octavius, obviously the mechanical arms are this harness that was designed when he couldn't control them before the accident, before he could control them telekinetically. So they still have the control dials on the chest plate. So he realizes, okay, he stretches his arms around and puts his own fingers in the dials and twists them so that the arms retract. And that's, he can't do that. He can't keep them like that forever, but it's long enough to talk to him. And now he's talking to Dr. Octopus. And this is the page that I would love to own, this page, because it is just beautiful. And it is, to, again, to me, the definition of Reed Richards. He says, now look, I came to you in good faith, Octavius, because you, in this area, you are clearly my better. It costs me absolutely nothing to admit that. You are my better here, and I need you. Now, you have a choice right now. You can either decide to pursue your own ego, or you can try to save the lives of an innocent unborn baby and her mother, his or her mother. The choice is yours. And so he just, and well, how do I know that? How do I know that you're, this isn't just a trick? And he says, because I'm releasing you now. And now he just says that the choice is absolutely up to you. And cut to the next scene, which they're back in the flying bathtub, and the bathtub is landing on the hospital roof, and they're going to try to save the baby. And that's exactly the sort of Reed Richards that I don't really recognize in the version that new readers come to see. The one that says that I don't know everything. I'm really, really good at the things that have fascinated me that I've worked with, but there's so much that I have not even touched on. There are people who are huge experts. And that's the reason why you often have scenes in which he's inviting other scientists into the Baxter building, because they have an insight or they have a technique that he doesn't know about. And he will, it's just like he's like an intellectual jazz musician. And he's just eager to have another person sitting in and jamming with him intellectually. And his, particularly when the lives of his family are not at stake, the ability, the joy he takes in just discovery that I did not know that, or I had, that's an idea that would not have occurred to me were we not here noodling away at this hour after hour after hour, bouncing ideas off of each other. The joy he gets in just knowing things that he didn't know before, not the ego of, ha, now I'm the master, only I could have figured this out. So that's what I love about the character, and I just don't recognize that character in the way that the modern comics are being written. And so that's what bothers me. I think I don't blame people for thinking that Reed Richards is actually useless. I just think it's a feedback loop where there was a joke that got out of hand. And then just like, you see the, that great movie, Sneakers with Robert Redford.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's the conversation that, that he has with Ben Kingsley's character is absolutely true. It's like, here's how the world works. Like the bank is solid. And then you start a rumor that the bank is going to fail. And then people start to take their money out. And then the bank actually will fail because now people have been taking their money out. So that's the cycle that I think that Reed Richards, the character, has been stuck in. Where it's a good, one of the best characters, one of the most useful characters to the Marvel Universe. Because when you need to compress 8 issues of facts and exposition into a page and a half, or even half a page, you have the character visit Reed Richards. And he will say, oh, well, I think I'm glad you stopped by because I think that this is the problem. I think that this is what you have to go and do. Or, oh, well, you've lost your powers. But you know what? There's a funny one where, what was the character that was Wolverine's illegitimate son who had some of his powers, he had tattoos and a mohawk. But he was stripped of his powers, and another really nice, this is a recent one, another really cool Reed Richards moment by people who know how to write Reed Richards, where he just drops by and he became not maybe a friend, but sort of someone that the Fantastic Four realized was sort of at risk and they wanted to help him out a little bit. And so he lost his claws, or he lost his ability to fight. And so I said, well, actually, you know, Reed goes into a drawer and pulls out this claw sort of apparatus thing. So like, I made it for Tigra, like as a present, but I never actually finished it. If you like, you know, you can use it. I'm sure you'll be able to figure out how to use it. That's the sort of thing that Reed Richards is great for in the Marvel Universe. He's also Basil Exposition, where you can really set things in motion just by having someone visit this man who probably has a hunch about everything and has a solution for almost everything. I'm sorry, just to wrap it up, it's that's the that's not the Reed Richards that most stories tend to go for. So when people pick up one of these issues, they hear about the Reed Richards that is so focused on his work that he ignores his saint of his wife, and he's a terrible husband, and he will put other people in danger because he's got this this cockamamie theory, or he'll do something because he's unquestioning a tool of the government in S.H.I.E.L.D., and he won't consider the moral implications of anything. That's the way he's been written, and so therefore, again, that cycle then closes itself, and now he actually is this character. So I would just like to see a return to the Reed Richards that, for lack of a better word, I fell in love with as a teenager who discovered Marvel Comics.
Well, that you grew up with. I mean, you've never made any secret that you grew up reading the Fantastic Four, and that, you know, you are more of a fan of those, what we would now think of as, you know, old Fantastic Four than the modern ones. So, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that, as long as you're sort of open and, you know, yeah, transparent about your biases.
Well, you do have to. I mean, and also, before we go any further, it's important to acknowledge that, I mean, it's so selfish for people who are in their 40s, who discovered comics in their teens, to expect no forward progress or no changes to any of these characters. I'm sure that when the first Secret Wars series came out in the 1980s, there were a lot of longtime fans who became Marvel fans in the 60s and 70s who thought, this is terrible. It's promotion for a toy line, for God's sakes. Stan Lee, Jack Kirby would never be involved in anything like this. And I'm sure, I'm also certain that John Byrne, who is my still, it's hard to say that you have a favorite Fantastic Four writer above Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. But if we designate Lee and Kirby as favorite Americans,
they're untouchable.
Exactly. Yeah. We have to give them a special position in the higher than most holy. Then he would be my favorite Fantastic Four creator. But I'm sure, again, there are people that do not recognize the version of the Fantastic Four that he was writing. So I'm glad that the Fantastic Four was in the shape that it was in when I first discovered it there. And also, I am really, really happy if 10, 20, 30 years later, oh my God, it is 30 years later. if there's a version of the Fantastic Four or Reed Richards that I don't like and I don't recognize, it would be so selfish for me to not be happy for a new generation that is going to see something in this book that they actually like and that brings them into comics. I'm never going to say
if they are enjoying it. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Goodness gracious, can you think of any piece of entertainment that you enjoyed for more than 5 years consistently? If the entirety of my happiness in reading Fantastic Four was only from the 1980s to 2008, 2009, whenever Mark Waid ended his run. Goodness gracious, what a great run that was! So I'm not upset with it. I just wish that he were more of a whatever happens to the character, however they move the character forward, however they change the definition of the team, however they change the definition of the family. I do think that part of the value of this book is the unique relationship between Reed Richards and the rest of his family, and I believe that has to be intact for Fantastic Four to be what it is, as opposed to just four people who are on a team. It's never been just four people who are on a team. It's always been a unique engine of the relationships between these four people.
Well, and they've always been regarded, in fact, aren't they sort of nicknamed the first family of the Marvel Universe?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that gets to the heart of that right there, really.
Yeah, and don't you always also like, I like the fact that there are certain heroes that have this reputation even within the Marvel Universe, where the four members of the Beatles will never not be the Beatles, never. And it doesn't matter even if Paul McCartney is releasing a holiday album of like 1940s and 1950s standards, which is something that almost every rock and roller does when they're 60 or 70. Any of that, because they will always have that reputation. He will always be Paul damn McCartney, and Ringo will always be Ringo damn Starr. And the other ones that we've lost are always going to be George damn Harrison and John damn Lennon. I love the fact that within the Marvel Universe, the Fantastic Four have that same sort of thing, where if if a couple of lower tier characters are solving a problem on the streets and Reed and Sue are just in their civvies and they stroll by and try to lend a hand, those people, that their minds are going to be blown away that they get to do good alongside, oh my God, Reed Richards and Sue Storm. I can't believe it. Like Tom Hanks dropping in like an acting studio, or Adele, who's just strolling through a farmer's market, and she comes across like three or four Christmas carolers and decides to join in, and like, oh my God, I know it's just like one song and it's nothing, my life will not change, but I can't believe I actually get to sing a song with Adele. I love the fact that there's so few heroes in the Marvel Universe that have that sort of reputation in that community, and the Fantastic Four will always be the Beatles of the Marvel Universe, and that has to be preserved, and it has to be that's so valuable.
I wonder if that's, this is a bit of an aside, but I wonder if actually that's diminished a little now, because that reputation was originally sort of born on the fact that they were, I mean, not only were they the first heroes of the sort of modern incarnation of Marvel Comics, but within the Marvel Universe timeline, they were the first superheroes. And of course, that's no longer the case. There have now been so many series set before the Fantastic Four, where there were, in fact, it turns out there were other superheroes, you know. I wonder if that status has diminished a little bit, and maybe that's what has, or one of the things that has allowed writers to feel like they can play with that a little, and that, you know, Reed Richards isn't untouchable, and maybe they can, you know, put their own spin on him and make him more of a, well, less of a likable character.
Yeah, I can imagine that that would be true. It must be difficult. I mean, I'm a writer. I also write fiction. long ago gave up writing spec scripts for comics, but I've often, you can't be a writer and you can't be a fan of comics without thinking, gee, if I got a hold of this character, if I got a hold of this book or this character, here's what I'd love to do with it. And it must be really, really hard when you're dealing with a character that is, has as big of a legacy as the Fantastic Four, and try to figure out, there has been five decades of stories with the Fantastic Four.
What can I do?
What? You start off with, what can I do that has not already been done 10 times? And then you have to start with, well, I want to make my mark on this. I want to leave this book in better shape than what I found it in. And I did find it in pretty good shape when it was handed to me. I want to leave this book with, so that the next writer has way more opportunities than I had.
See, that's a very generous attitude towards the writer's role in comics. that's not always how it happens. For one thing, there's often just not that much forethought, frankly. But also, I mean, in the case of Daredevil, famously, the Daredevil Volume 2, each writer, Bendis to Brubaker, and then Brubaker to Diggle and myself, deliberately left the writer who was to follow in a pickle with a conundrum, like a seemingly unsolvable problem, rather than saying, here, I've given you all these opportunities. It was more a kind of, ha-ha, get out of that.
The worst thing you can do is make people think, my God, the writer who followed up me was so good. He really improved it. So yeah, right. If you really want to leave them in the spit. Yeah, I mean, I thought that someday we can do another one of these episodes about Tigra. But when I gave you the example of the character, the writer who just is known for this type of story, and no matter what they do, they're probably going to want to write that story whether it fits or not. The Tigra got a limited series, and it was the written by I don't know whether she was the series creator, but there was a Witchblade TV show on one of the cable stations at the cable networks at the time, and that whole story was set in a police precinct, and it was all like police procedural oriented. And so I'm picking up because this Tigra is that character where I feel like, oh, I know exactly where I would take that character. There's so much opportunity here. And so I pick up the book, and Tigra, to solve a mystery, decides to join the police academy and become a police officer. Like, she would really do that? Oh, okay. And it happened with Brian Michael Bendis when he took over the Avengers, where he needed like a kind of a weak character that could easily be intimidated and beaten up and manipulated into doing something. And it seems as though he doesn't like that character much at all. So he has her get beat up by a guy with a handgun, the Hood in one of the new Avengers issues. And I'm like, I have read pretty much every story that this character has been in. This is not how any of those confrontations have ever gone. It doesn't, some guy with a gun doesn't like hit her with the gun and then she begs, oh, stop, oh, please, oh, please. She goes really nutso, and then that person winds up without the gun, without the arm, and wondering, gosh, isn't this a jolly hole in my chest? Hey, shouldn't a human heart be in there? And then plop.
This does get to the question of evolving characters, though, which is something you touched on before. And, you know, now that I think about it, I'm kind of put in mind of the same situation that, of course, writers have with Doctor Who, which is something that people who don't read comics will probably be more familiar with, which is this idea that, yes, you have a character who's been around 40, 50 years and has been through, I mean, in Doctor Who's case, obviously through literal reincarnations. But within the span of a long comics run like the Fantastic Four, you get the same sort of thing where each writer coming in will treat the characters a little differently and will treat Reed Richards a little differently. And I think it's the same for any writer on any book that has an established previous history, is that yes, you're right, some of the ways that characters are written won't necessarily jibe with what you might have read before, but they are hopefully close enough that they're recognizable and then allow the writer to and the artist, in the case of many sort of design changes and stuff as well, allow them to at least do their own thing with that character.
Yeah, and I think that everybody, I think it's second nature to, you have your favorite characters. Like Bendis obviously had a lot of love for Jessica Drew, the Spider-Woman. And boy, she really rescued that character and made her way, way more interesting than just a distaff knockoff of Spider-Man. Just as John Byrne took She-Hulk and found a way to make her interesting. And again, something a lot more interesting than just add a female modifier to the existing character, male character's right. name. I can't pretend that, again, if I did get to write a Tigra series, yes, I'd be focused on that character, and then I might need, we need her to like take to do what I would want to do. To illustrate this, I need her to sort of take another less experienced hero under her wing and sort of show her the ropes. And then I would probably pick one that I thought would suit my needs. And if I'm just looking to fill a role as opposed to building a story around somebody, maybe I wouldn't read every single issue of Squirrel Girl. And then I wouldn't learn that, she's not the most powerful character in the world, but she's always cheerful. She's always optimistic. And she always attacks something head on. She's never the sort of person who says, gee, I don't know what to do in this situation. And so I could make the mistake of abusing that character. And every comic, Tom Brevoort in his Tumblr blog keeps saying that every character is somebody's favorite. And so there's going to be a Squirrel Girl fan who's like, oh my God, that Anatko guy just totally ruined Squirrel Girl. Well, why did they let him write Squirrel Girl? One of the crown jewels of the Marvel pantheon. So it's really, we get back to the word selfish. You can't be selfish either as a writer or a reader and expect that there's a phrase I keep saying when I'm talking to my friends about comics, especially when I'm talking about what I like, just to make sure people know that I'm not going off the deep end here. It's always like, I appreciate that if I were to look at a copy of Marvel's business plan, it does not, the phrase, we will only publish books that Andy Anatko personally will like. I don't think that phrase is anywhere in their business plan. I think their point is to try to make money, and if that's not a vulgar term, because when you make money, you get to keep publishing comics and you get to keep paying people to publish comics, and all of those things are good things.
Yeah, I'm reminded of a good friend of mine, Andrew Wheeler, who is the now the editor-in-chief of Comics Alliance. He has, I'm going to credit this to him. Actually, he might well let me know that it was somebody else, but I think he came up with this, which is basically the sort of that there are no bad characters. There are just bad stories featuring those characters, but that every character is redeemable in some way, and every character has the potential to be in a good story. And I think there's, in recent times, there's no better illustration of that than the Warren Ellis, Declan Shalvey Moon Knight run.
Yeah.
Because for years, Moon Knight was a joke. And there were many, many people who tried to relaunch Moon Knight and did a, I won't say did a bad job of it, but did an, had an unsuccessful job of it, you know, did not succeed. And then Warren and Declan come along and somehow just nail it and absolutely get the, you know, what people want about the character, what people want now in particular for a character like that. And now Moon Knight is enormous and they're talking about making a TV series of it. It's, you know, and again, that's a character who was, I won't say quite as much of a joke as She-Hulk before John Byrne got hold of She-Hulk, but not far off, that kind of level of just a sort of a punchline.
He just seemed kind of unnecessary, you know?
Right, right, it's,
He seemed like a...
Much like She-Hulk did before John Byrne.
Right.
Did his, legendary series with it, because you're right, he absolutely redeemed that character.
Yeah, and it really just comes down to have... I think that a lot of it is... I think every writer has a favorite character too. And just having the attitude that every character can be an A-list character if he or she is just written that way.
Right.
And if you cast someone in that central role, again, it doesn't even matter. Squirrel Girl, Tigra, even Ms. Marvel, who became Captain Marvel, that's probably even a better example, where just someone decided that you'd have this largely, I don't mean this in critical fashion, but always written as a largely superfluous character, where my perception as a reader, it was that no writer who handled her had come up with those, that one sentence or those two sentences in their own heads that would define who this character is,
right,
and why they need to exist. And therefore you have to fit, okay, geez, what if we give her a drinking problem and she is struggling against her drinking problem? Okay, no, it's okay. We'll do okay. That kind of
people, right? But that's a quirk rather than a purpose.
Yeah, exactly. The famous line about character development is that sometimes what you have to do with a character is chase them up a tree and then get them out, throw rocks at the step one is. No, I'm sorry. That was the definition of the three act structure, where you chase a character up a tree in act one. In act two, you throw rocks at them in the tree. And then in act three, you get them down from the tree. But sometimes it feels as though you're just putting them in a situation where you can throw rocks at them. And a lot of times I feel as though there's this artificial sense where you have to have a family member die, or you have to make them a victim of terrible violence, or you have to have this apocalyptic thing happening. I have always felt that if you want to write a scene on stage, on film, in a comic, anything, if you really want to give yourself a challenge, you don't have someone go through a breakup. You don't give a character cancer. You put them in a restaurant and you give them a bowl of soup to eat. Can you write a scene in which they're just eating a bowl of soup, and then you learn what it is to be this character from the way they order the soup, the way that he or she interacts with the waiter? Do they put crackers in? Do they eat it? Do they sample it first before putting in cheese or pepper? Or do they feel, I know that I like lots of pepper, so I'm going to pepper this soup before I eat it. It's easy to do when you give someone, the size of the rocks you throw at them are the sort of rocks that will always provoke screams and shouts and anger and some sort of reaction. Right. It's difficult when you just say, put them in the field. There's a tree over there. Do what you want to do, character. Is your impulse to go to the base of the tree and have a nap because it's shady and it'll protect you from the rain? Are you going to climb the tree to get a better look around? Are you going to use the tree as a basis of reference so that when you walk someplace else, you know what direction is which? Those are the sort of stories that really get me. And sometimes, again, I always have to underscore this, not as an expert on drama or as an expert on comics, but simply as a reader, there are times where you feel as though someone is in the field and then they get hit by a meteor and the meteor opens and there's a monster in there. And
robots. Wait.
Exactly. And you can do that to Superman. You can do that to Moon Knight. You can do that to Squirrel Girl. You can do that to anybody. Show me what this character is going to do. That's what really gets me hooked. That's what will get that $4 a month out of me forever.
Well, there is an old, and I don't recall the exact phrasing of it, but there's an old writer's sort of adage about, you know, if you can take two characters, put them in an empty room together and know what they will say to each other, then you know your characters. Like, that's how you know you've got characters who have personalities and purpose and that you know well enough to, you know, to write properly. And it's a similar sort of thing. It's about giving a character some drive and some motivation beyond reacting, as you say, in the case of superheroes, to meteors landing and giant robots and lasers and aliens. And you're right, that Kelly Sue did an amazing job on that with Captain Marvel, turning her from a character who did seem to lack a bit of purpose and giving her, I mean, not only obviously Jamie McKelvey's wonderful costume redesign, oh, man, Captain Marvel, but also giving her, you know, a sense of purpose as a character, giving her taglines like the higher, further, faster, more, and we will become the stars we were always meant to be, every little girl flies, all these little phrases that now stick in the mind when you think of that character. So here's a question for you. What do you think that is for Reed Richards? Bringing it back to Reed Richards, what is his kind of purpose and defining characteristic in that sense?
I think his defining characteristic is that he is an explorer. And he is endlessly fascinated by the world around him. And he is deeply aware that there is not enough time in his lifetime to answer all the questions that fascinate him. And that is always at conflict with his love for his family and his desire to make good lives for the people around him. And that's why I've always felt as though the defining one of the defining cards in the relationship between Sue and Reed is how comfortable they are with who each other, with who each of them are. Again, going back to the Reed is a jerk meme that you see, he'll lock himself in the lab and he'll never leave because he'll ignore his family. That's why he's terrible. That's not the Reed Richards that I think is central to the character. The Reed Richards that's central to the character is the person who is. Yes, he will get kind of wrapped up in his work because he is unraveling something that is amazing. That is incredible. He's not doing it to get away from his family. It's because this is the engine that drives him. And it's that sort of drive and that sort of delight he takes in busting through barriers that Sue loves. And Sue would be pleased if they have a date to take out the kids for ice cream at 5, he would shut everything down at 4:45 and then change into clothes and be ready in the lobby for them at 5. She knows that that's not the person that he married, but he also knows that the person that he married is someone who will turn off all of those machines when he is reminded. And the analogy I keep coming up with, and if I were going to write a scene in which Sue has to explain this to one of her friends, it's like, you have a husband, right? Yeah. Does he love football? Yeah, pretty much. Okay. He looks forward to the Super Bowl. Oh yeah, he's thinking about that for like weeks beforehand. Okay. I want you to imagine that it's the Super Bowl, not even a regular game. It's the Super Bowl. And there are 2 minutes left to play. And there's 3 points separating his favorite team in the world from winning the Super Bowl. And 2 minutes before the end of the game, you come in and remind him that this is usually the time that you and the kids go out to get ice cream. Does he turn off the Super Bowl 2 minutes before the end of the game on a 3-point difference to go out and get ice cream with the kids? Because Reed will do that. And every time he's in his lab, it is almost literally true that he could be 30 minutes away from curing all known forms of cancer and vaccinating everybody against ever getting cancer again. But he has learned that he doesn't want to be just part of a piece of lab apparatus. He wants to be a good father and a good husband. So he will turn off this research and join us and just have a dish of ice cream with us. That's why my husband is a wonderful husband and a wonderful father.
On the other hand, if it's only 3 points, it'll probably just end up going into overtime anyway. If it's a 2-point difference, then you're going to have to drag him away from the screen.
They'll find a way to put 3 more commercials in there, definitely.
Yeah. Okay, that's interesting. So let's talk about the movies. Partly because you are notoriously known in the podcasting world as somebody who did not enjoy the first Avengers movie very much. So I wonder, given that they're not made by obviously the same studio, what have you thought of the various movie versions of Reed Richards? Have you seen all the Fantastic Four movies?
Yeah, I haven't seen. I saw the recent Fantastic Four movie in the theater, only because I was really curious about it. The previous two from Fox, I'd seen, I think, eventually when they came to cable or when they came to video.
Right.
And I think I must somewhere from the 1990s or the early 2000s, I have a cassette from a con of the bootleg version of the Roger Corman version.
Oh, no, not the Roger Corman. No.
Yeah. I mean, oh, I feel so sorry for all those actors because
I'm not counting that one.
Oh, God.
I don't think anybody counts that one.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's such a tough nut to crack. I won't fault anybody involved in either of those three movies. I didn't really like any of them, but good God, I appreciate what a difficult story that is to tell.
Well, but stories aside, do you think any of the actors cracked it, or do you think there were any sort of nice moments where the writers clearly, you know, got to the essence of the character?
I think that in the recent movie, the 3 hours they spent before they actually get their powers, there are a bunch of moments in the lab where you see that that version of Reed Richards that is just committed to exploration and to just learning, and to just, if there is a loose thread anywhere in the universe, he has to pull at that thread until he finds out what it means and what piece of information is at the other end of that thread. A little bit of a dork, but a lovable dork. He can get a little bit carried away, but he's at his core, he's always immensely responsible. I liked that. I'd have to say that I liked the last movie more than the previous two. If we've already established that I didn't really like any of the three, I at least.
Right, but that's interesting given that the most recent one is the most radical, well,
yeah,
by most modern fans anyway, regarded as the most radical reworking of the concept.
Yeah, and that's because I feel as though the previous two movies only went in halfway with the Fantastic Four. I really think that if I were to plan the greatest, if my version of the best Fantastic Four movie, you would have to start off with the team 7 years into their career. I mean, at this point, we all know that
established veterans.
Exactly. We don't need to see Superman as a baby crashing to the planet. We know who Superman is. Even if we didn't know who Superman was, we know the idea of a superhero. So we can basically just jump into the adventure. And the fun of the Fantastic Four is usually just seeing what a bunch of two super, super freaks and two people who are slightly less freaky, but their powers are such that they can pass as non-freaks, but how at ease they are with their lives and with each other. The classic family relationship where you absolutely don't understand what that person is doing with that person. You don't understand why you just like to hang out with your brother like that when your brother is just so abrasive and such a jerk. And you don't know Johnny the way that we know Johnny. I've witnessed the entirety of his life. Ben and Reed have witnessed at least the last 13 years of his life. We know things about each other that no one outside can know. And we are inseparable. We know exactly what makes each one of these people really, really great. And it's wonderful to be able to observe that sort of thing and just learn about these characters through what might be a very conventional adventure with the four of them. And I don't think that the previous two movies embraced that at all. I also don't think they really locked into the other way that I think you can make a really interesting Fantastic Four movie, which is to focus on the fact that these people, before they got their powers, are nothing like the people they became 5 years after getting their powers. Where you have Reed Richards, who was a professor, he was an academic, he was extremely respected, just like Dean Kamen would be today, just like Richard Feynman would be today, and he usually acts by researching in a lab and publishing papers. He isn't physical. He's respected. He's deeply cerebral. And after this accident, he has to be somebody who actually goes out and fights things directly and addresses immediate problems. He's not dealing with hypothetical things or things that are basically based on tests. He has to deal with things that are actually trying to destroy the energy field around the planet and figure out how to save it. He's used to being in a wool jacket with patches on the elbows and a little sweater and pants and shoes, in awe with 300, 400 people in the lecture hall in awe of him and these ideas he's presenting. And now he has to be like an inflatable balloon floating above Times Square to lift people, to basically keep this bag of noxious gas from actually settling over the people and looking absolutely ridiculous. And he has to go from this person who would publish that paper. He would publish this new theory that two iterations of scientists later would use that research as a basis to figure out how to create yield from a nuclear weapon that would be 100 and then 1,000 times greater at no extra cost or complexity, and he'd be very, very distant from the results of far-reaching results of his research. And now he is confronted every single day with, I almost killed my three best friends. Even if Johnny Storm seems to be really elated that he has superpowers, I still, even that best of those four cases, those three cases, I nearly killed him because I rushed in and was just too excited to get the results of this experiment. And he will be living with that responsibility for the rest of his life. That's why Mark Waid is one of my favorite Fantastic Four writers. And partly was because that very first issue, that 9-cent issue, this is why you love writers who figure out a way to advance the characters and let us know something more about them without necessarily negating what's gone on for 30, 40 years. And he really made it clear that there's a reason why we're in garish blue costumes. There's a reason why we have the flying bathtub, this amazing flying car. There's a reason why I chose the name Mr. Fantastic. And there's a reason why that we have licensing and we have t-shirts and the Baxter building has a gift shop and that stuff, because I can't give them their normal lives back. So what I can do though is make them celebrities, make them beloved by the entire world, give them a life where they're not treated as freaks and monsters, but they are honored as heroes there. And it won't make up for what I've done to them, but maybe it will, make up for a little bit of what I've done to them. That he just is burdened with this every day of his life. It'd be interesting for a movie to just go like that. That was part of the disappointment of those first two Fantastic Four movies where, oh, goodness gracious! I can stretch my arm to grab that bottle. Isn't that interesting? Oh, Sue! Oh, well, Reed! Isn't that wow? I'm now completely invisible, huh? Ain't that a stitch? It's like no! incredibly weird things are happening, and I've always wanted to see that. I think one of the smartest things that Stan and Jack did was to have that flash forward where you see them calling out of the wreckage of the rocket, their powers manifest, and then you flash forward several months into the future, because that would be a very, very hard set of scenes to write. I really wanted to see, at some point you do want to see Reed that is waking up and he's just a puddle of rubber on the bed and he has to try to figure out like how to make his legs move and
how to control himself properly. Yeah,
exactly. And Sue, you know, okay, well, I'm brushing my teeth and suddenly I have no skin. Okay. Let's see if we can try. I want to vomit because I've never seen my own intestines before. Let's see how we can fix that now.
Have you read Warren Ellis's Planetary?
Yes.
Yeah. That's pretty much what you're describing.
I just love it when, I don't think that anybody really dislikes that sort of intense and dark view on superheroes, because there's so much gold still in the ground that has not been touched. And when you find a writer who has that perspective and that point of view that can write a whole new kind of superhero story you've never seen before. And it's clearly written from the point of view of someone who loves superhero stories. You feel as though, well, we decided to look in the side of this hill instead. And well, what do you know? There's even more gold over there. We thought that we were down to just, you know, gold dust and no more nuggets left. But look, now we're hauling up new gold by buckets and buckets and buckets. I think that people aren't upset by that. They're only upset when someone comes to a Fantastic Four book that really should be optimistic and bright and has to turn it into, well, these people are just hate each other. And everybody realizes that Reed Richards is a controlling super jerk. And, you know, they really, all three of them just want to kill him at any time because he's such a jerk. It's like, okay, I mean, and then I mean, it's almost a trope at this point, like where you find out that, again, getting back to, oh my God, I'm the new writer of a book that's been published for 30 or 40 years. What can I do that hasn't been done before? I know what we think we know has never been true at all. It was actually Reed Richards who intentionally, it's not just there was no shielding. There was actually lenses to focus and enhance the cosmic rays to turn them into superheroes because he wanted to experiment on them. He just didn't know that it would affect him as well as everybody else. Like, oh God, please don't go there. there are times like that they've been doing that a couple of times with the Doom Patrol, where the chief now is this really sick sick bastard who's just sort of keeping the members of the Doom Patrol dependent upon him in some way, shape, or form to make sure that they would never leave him, and he's responsible directly or indirectly for them becoming freaks in the first place. And we've been talking about how you want a new writer to respect what has gone on before. But there have been times where I thought, if this new writer started page one of his first book with just an actual like photograph of a handwritten note that said, okay, please assume that the following three things never happened. Because otherwise I'd have to write like a two issue story arc that resets things to so this horrible thing was never true to begin with. And you'd know that that's the reason why I did it. Can we all agree this is just a comic book? We can just get right to the good stuff where Sue Storm is not half insect now and Johnny Storm was not actually replaced by a robot with it that has half of the soul of Peter Parker's Uncle Ben. Can we just say that the past 18 issues were a wonderful little piece of fan fiction that we all enjoyed? We had some good laughs at, but I really don't want this in my house anymore. And this is now my house.
Well, you know, there's a school of thought that says all work for hire superhero writing is fan fiction. So, you know, but let's not go down that road. One of the things that you, one thought that came to mind after hearing you talk about sort of Reed's transformation from the professor into obviously having to become a hero is that, of course, the other thing he has to do now is make decisions based not on evidence, based like purely on hypotheses. You know, he's making, like any hero and certainly any action hero, making decisions with consequences on the spur of the moment. And just thinking about that in relation to the fact that he is supposed, you know, a scientist and, you know, supposed to be, if not the smartest man in the Marvel Universe, certainly one of the smartest. That is an interesting sort of change for the character to have gone through. And I wonder if that's underexplored, maybe.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen that's those kinds of stories told, and that's true of everybody too in the group. I mean, that's to me that's one of the most interesting untapped areas of the Fantastic Four mythos. That another meme is that, oh, listen, it wasn't Reed really horrible to Sue and just saying, oh, no, hide in the cellar, Sue, because the men are going to be fighting now. I actually think that should be embraced, because it makes Sue into such a wonderful character that if you embrace and accept as canon that she was the character that didn't know how to use her powers thoughtfully, she used them mostly for defense to protect herself and to hide away. And as she kept on fighting, as she kept on having adventures as an equal member of the team, she realized that, gee, I'm not really pulling my weight. I need to train. I need to explore. And I need to become more of an active participant. And, of course, you have these couple of early issues and where Reed is actually working with Sue to teach her how to fight. And, well, you know, I think it might be possible for you to actually erect force fields, not just become invisible, and not only helping her to realize her potential, but to discover her own potential as it goes. Isn't it interesting that you start off with this character that you presume, I think there have been some stories told about her life as being responsible for Johnny after losing both of their parents. But not, it's interesting that you have this character who is probably 22, 23, that when she gets her powers, that at that point she hasn't really figured out who she is or what she wants to do. She hasn't really formed her identity as apart from the person who has to make sure that Johnny Storm graduates from high school and doesn't wind up in prison for just, you know, cutting class and doing stupid things with cars. And she has to form herself into a super heroine. The idea that Ben Grimm, who grew up and boarded that rocket ship as something akin to a god, this Adonis, this person that, you know, women want to be with me, men want to be me, football hero, hero pilot, just every single positive opportunity. And now he comes back from that turned into literally a monster, someone that people will scream and run away from, and someone whose solution to most of the problems that he would confront to be, I'm a survivor of Yancey Street. I'll fight anybody for any reason if that's what they want to do. And now he's stuck in this body where if he fights, he will kill somebody. And if he pushes too hard on a door because he's frustrated, he will not just tear the door off the hinges. He might tear the house down. So now he has to move very, very gently and very, very deliberately and consider every single move he makes and not assume that if he appears in public that anybody will want to see him. Johnny Storm, he's more literal because this is one of the problems I had with the first two Fox Fantastic Four movies. They basically cast an underwear model in his mid-20s, and that's not a good look for Johnny Storm. That's how you make him look like an absolute jerk, not just a lovable jerk, but I want to use a word that's a little bit more, a little bit harsher, but might lose the populist rating of the show. But it starts with a D and it rhymes with ick. I mean, it's like when Johnny Storm is 15 or 16 years old and gawky and geeky looking, and he is reacting to Ben Grimm, who has within the past week or two been turned into this grotesque monster, and he's playing pranks on he's saying, hey, where are your ears? Like, you can say, okay, he's 15 or 16. Every 15 or 16 year old has no idea what they're talking about, and they're jerks. They make jokes that they don't know what the jokes are about. When you're 26, you're one of these stupid man boys, man children that it just doesn't care about any other person. And you really, I wound up finding myself just hating Johnny Storm in this movie. But in the comics, it's a wonderful idea that you're a teenager. He's not particularly bad looking. He's not particularly good looking. He's not particularly scrawny, but he's not particularly strong. He could go out for the football team and he might, or the basketball team, and he will probably make the team and he might get into a couple of games. That's where he is. He's not unpopular, but he's not popular. And suddenly the genie descends and grants him this wish that I will make you a superhero. I will give you the most awesome superpowers ever. And what does that do to you when you're 15, 16 years old and you're used to, you have an okay opinion of yourself, but not a great opinion of yourself, and suddenly people are looking up to you, and suddenly people want to see you show off, and you're in a place where you haven't defined yourself yet either, and you choose to define yourself as someone that everybody loves to see, that you're the star in the center of attention. That's why I think that's an interesting area that people haven't gone into, just seeing the differences between these people that they had to, as a result of this crash, they became completely different people. Marvel did a while ago a series called Before the Four, where you have an adventure with Reed Richards, Professor Reed Richards, I think before he even was dating, when he was 23, 24, 25, and an adventure with Sue and Johnny Storm again about when they were teenagers, and Ben Grimm. And that wasn't I thought that it might have been an entertaining book, but I thought that it was counterproductive, because if you have Reed Richards, who can be dragged by a colleague into an Indiana Jones style adventure, and he's basically being Indiana Jones, you're basically saying that he always had this derring do, adventuresome, physical, let's go travel the world, and let's go fight things, and let's go, and that he didn't change as a result of his experience in the rocket ship. And I always thought that that was a bad thing. I would love to do a story, or rather read a story, or do a story where you do see Sue Storm at 19 or 20 and be kind of useless, well-intentioned, but she doesn't know. There's a guy with a gun. I'm just going to run in the other direction, because what can I do against a guy with a gun? And be kind of kicking yourself, thinking that maybe I could have distracted him, or maybe I could have done something else. Why did I just run all the way home? It wouldn't diminish the Invisible Woman. It would, and if anything, I think, impress you that this is not someone who was granted, who came into this world with every advantage, that she is who she is because she made herself into what she is. And that's an interesting vein that I don't think has been pursued yet.
Yeah. It's I haven't read that miniseries, but it is always a danger with prequels if you sort of do stuff. Well, it's like the young Indiana Jones series as well, to an extent, where you are supposedly telling stories before they were heroes, but to make the stories interesting, they've got to still be heroes.
You have to
in
recognize
those
them,
yeah. Stories, yeah. So it's kind of, it is a very, very tricky one to pull off. But one of the things that I have, I'm not a huge Fantastic Four reader. I've read a bit, but I'm not, you know, sort of an avid reader or anything. But one of the things I have always liked about Reed Richards as a character is that he is smart. I mean, yes, he can bend his body into ridiculous shapes and stuff, but the main thing everybody knows about Reed Richards is that he's the smartest guy in the room. And that is, you know, it's an interesting take for a superhero, for a especially for a medium that is so visual and so built around, you know, people in skin-tight costumes punching one another. The fact that this character's primary guiding characteristic is smart, and, you know, as shown in many, many stories over the years, I know, using those smarts to outwit, whether it's Dr. Doom or Doc Ock or the Mole Man or whoever, you know, their enemies, rather than just sheer physical brute force, actually outsmarting them and using sort of intelligent tactics and having a long-term strategy and being able to look at the bigger picture, to use a cliche. I just think that's a really good, positive thing to take from a superhero book. You know, that one of the most important characters in the Marvel Universe is valued because he's smart, not because he's stronger than everybody else, not because he's faster than everybody else, not because he can shoot laser beams out of his eyes, but because he's really, really smart.
Yeah, absolutely. It's always been a great combination of the two. We were talking at the start of the show about how he has a wonderful superpower for comics, where it's, and I think that it could be a really good reflection of his personality, that I would love to see a version of his lab where now that he's been made out of rubber for about 14 or 15 years, like this is just his body and how he understands his reality. And so if he's laying things out in his lab, of course he's going to be putting, like, I can put two more screens if I stack them like vertically and put like 3 inches of space between them, because I can just flatten my head and slide it in like a toaster slot.
Right.
And look at these sort of things. And so he looks like this incredibly freaky or hysterically funny, bizarre shape in his lab that he doesn't really care or know about, because this is just the most efficient way to get, you know, to do four times as much work in the amount of space. But yeah, I mean, if you could give up any one of those two attributes, he wouldn't still be Reed Richards if he were still elastic, but didn't have that level of brilliance. And it really is a unique kind of brilliance. Another thing that I would like to adjust if
go on, if we're playing wish list.
Yeah, I mean, if there's so much negativity in talk about comics online that I always feel a little bit defensive that I have to say. I'm not saying that this is objectively wrong about how some of these characters are done. I'm saying that I feel as though the optimal setting for this would be this, and I acknowledge that that's just my opinion. But if I could make one of my own adjustments, it would be that I don't like the idea that now there are if you create a brand new character, or if you have an existing character and you're the writer and you love this character and you really want to increase their standing, you have to suddenly say, well, this person is exactly as smart as Reed Richards, because Reed Richards is the smartest guy in the world. And the result, though, is that now you've got 13 people who are as smart as Reed Richards. And that does it. It makes you wonder if people were right in saying that this Reed Richards was all that smart to begin with. I like the, not that he has to be at the top of any specific pyramid. I think that it has to be, it's not just an acknowledgement that he's pretty smart. It's that he is creative and he's a lateral thinker, but also that he is always inviting other scientists and other people into his lab. He's the times that he has, there's been wonderful scenes in a bunch of different books from a bunch of different writers over many decades in which Peter Parker, whether that's, they knew that he was Spider-Man or not, but they have Spider-Man in, and Reed Richards knows that he's a very good scientist, and they're just working together. Again, they're just jamming together. I think that the reason why he is not very useful to call him the smartest person in the world, because what's smart anyway, but the most useful smart person in the world is that he can jam with just about anybody, and he can be that that signal that amplifies other signals around him. And he is the person who has been doing, he's not like Hank McCoy. He's not the master of the universe on mutant biology. He is someone, he's a polymath. He has explored absolutely everything. And if he doesn't have one of the best intellects on every specific discipline, he knows the person that he would like to bring in to show him the ropes and to work with on this specific discipline. And I think that that's his unique ability, that he has this total, despite being very, very proud of his own accomplishments, despite having chosen the name Mr. Fantastic, he is, for super, super smart people, he has just not a single trace of ego. And that's what makes him one of the most valuable characters in the Marvel Universe, and probably the most valuable member of the Fantastic Four.
A generous genius.
Yeah.
There you go, Marvel, if you're listening. There's your new tagline.
Yes.
All right, let's wrap it up. Andy, thank you very much for coming on the show. Where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
Well, the price of admission is you have to spell my last name, so it's a very exclusive club. If you can spell my last name, you can follow me on Twitter, which I'm Anatko, I-H-N as in Nancy, A-T as in Tom, K-O. Or you can go to my blog, which is anatko.com. And recognizing that it took myself about 14 or 15 years to spell my last name right, you can also go to CWOB.com, the Celestial Waste of Bandwidth. That's just like a landing page that will take you to links to the blog and a couple other...
I was going to say, when you said the URL, what happened to the Celestial Waste of Bandwidth? Is that surely that can't have died?
No, it did. It didn't. And also, as a four-letter domain, there's no way I'm giving that up ever.
Right. Yeah.
It's weird. I keep having this ongoing relationship with reinventing my website because I not only use it to publish thoughts that I have, but also as a way to learn more about web technologies and learn more about the scripting languages. And so I think that I had the Celestial Waste of Bandwidth was originally, it predated WordPress. And so I had to write all of my own software for maintaining and posting and updating it. And then I think that I'd also bought anatko.com just to keep it out of, I thought that, well, I didn't buy it for years because there's nobody else in the world named Anatko, or at least nobody else who would like care to own that domain. So I just didn't get around to it. Then I realized that, oh, I do have a cousin, like my father's brother's son, who isn't into technology, but he does have a 5-year-old son who at some point might just register it just for himself. So I better register it. So I had it, but it was parked. And so I think I used it when I first installed WordPress just to have something to point to while I was experimenting with WordPress. And then slowly I put more stuff on WordPress, and then anatko.com became the canonical one, and CWOB became the landing page. I'm just hoping that at some point there is some, like CBS merges with, like like a Bang & Olufsen or something.
With the WB or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And like, and suddenly I'll get like $2 million in free stereo equipment for life by selling it off to someone.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. And please remember to check out my comics, books, and music. Go to anthonyjohnston.com for information and links to all of my work. You can support the show by rating Unjustly Maligned on iTunes. And if you really like it, please leave a review. It's the best way to spread the word to new listeners. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. You can find information, links, and show notes at ump.fm. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Personal aside, Inotko, then, is that what do you think that was an Ellis Island mistake or something? Is it really that unique?
No, it isn't. Now that there's the internet, there are, for instance, there's a writer for AV Club, Gwen Inot, and there are other Inotkos that aren't necessarily related to me. I have come to realize that it's, I don't know, sort of like Rosenthal, you know, where. Maybe think of a word of someone you've met that has a slightly unusual name, but it's not necessarily true that you will never see somebody who has that name. So if I do a Google search for Inotko, fortunately I'm the number one hit.
Right.
but you can find other people like that. I don't know if I can count on that person being a relative anymore, but it's certainly right. Made me happy that I did reserve that name. Although there's another fun story though. I did kind of screw over every other Inotko on the planet because including my dad, I got an email from Apple once, from the, one of the scientists who works on their text-to-speech stuff. And they said, well, we'd like to like hardwire in a definition for your name so that if people do put Inotko in and it goes text-to-speech, we want to make sure it pronounces properly. Can you like give us 5 recordings of you saying your last name? And so give them the 5 recordings and I'll be darned. The next version of the OS came in and every subsequent one, it does in fact pronounce my name correctly. So you have to capitalize it so it knows that it's a proper name. I haven't checked it in a while, but I think it even it's even in the spell check as an exception. And so my dad, when I show this to him, was immensely proud because, oh my God, you mean that this entire operating system they actually took the time to make sure that your name is pronounced. My goodness, my son is not unimportant. This is interesting. And then he came to realize that now there's one problem, son. See, my father grew up in Western Pennsylvania where they park the car in Harvard Yard. So to speak, they really hit their R's. And the problem is, son, that I grew up in Boston, said, Andy, like, that's not how I pronounced our last name.
I knew you were going to
say that's not how my dad pronounced our last name. Because he would say Inotko. I say Inotko with a soft A from Boston. And I had to say, and I was like, for a moment embarrassed, I said, well, I'm sorry, Dad, but now it's like 41 million Macintoshes versus you. you're outvoted now.
Just for the record, by the way, I'm pretty sure it was actually Dr. Drang who said somebody should do Reed Richards, and then Merlin suggested you.
Ah.
But I'm pretty sure it was actually the internet's Dr. Drang who originally suggested Reed Richards as a topic.
I'm very grateful they did because this has been a ball. This is one of the most fun hours of conversation I've had in quite a while. Haven't you often read things in all kinds of genres where someone writes a Western because they hate Westerns and they think that every single Western trope is stupid and lazy and every
oh yeah, and those books are normally terrible. Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's like a, like the difference between Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven, where and oh forget that the recent movie A Million Ways to Die in the West. Where
I haven't seen
they're both. It's a comedy. It's with the guy who did Family Guy, And that movie it's a comedy, but he just walked around saying, "Oh my God, did you notice that? Like, it's kind of crazy that people walk in the middle of the street here and shoot each other. That's crazy, right?" And this is someone who just wants to say that, "Hi, I'm so much smarter than everybody who has ever made a Western before." Whereas Unforgiven, definitely a deconstructionist take on the Western, but by somebody who knows and loves Westerns.
The very first thing you started when you said, like, there's this quintessential panel that you wanted to talk, you know, that to you represented people's problems with Reed Richards. I really thought you were going to mention that panel from, I don't know, one of the early issues, I assume, where they all put their hands in the circle and it's like, and I'm the invisible girl and I'm the human torch. I'm some kind of thing. And then it's, and I'm going to be Mr. Fantastic.
Yeah, that's a good one too. But again, it's like, that's another thing that I think is so interesting about the challenge of writing these stories that have been characters that have been around for 40 years, that you know that the actual answer to the question is that this was written by Stan Lee in 1963. And they
are tossed off on a wet Wednesday afternoon.
Exactly.
Wasn't really thinking ahead.
And he knew that the title is Fantastic Four. And I guess that's why they're called the Fantastic Four. He's Mr. Fantastic. And it's always been funny to see it's always been interesting when some writers want to come up with a different explanation for that. Mark Waid did the most, I think the most interesting, the smartest one by saying that, yeah, I did choose this really stupid name because that's what's going to get attention. And that's what,
to be a larger than life celebrity.
If we call ourselves, my name, your name is going to be Princess Force Projector and you're going to be Mr. Flamewall Guy and you're going to be the Rock Monster and I'm going to be Fluido who can slip among you in any disguise. Well, that's scary, but Mr. Fantastic, yeah. You know, it's I think the Tom Balin,
it's something that you can sell toys of.
Yeah, exactly. That's that was if you don't have to explain things. I think that a lot of writers things I don't like as a reader is when I think that a writer has the explaining disease, where it's like, we have to explain why he designed it like a flying bathtub. Like, well, the answer is that Jack Kirby on that day thought that would be a cool design. No. We have to be that he was in a junkyard when he was 18 years old, and he turned that into a... No, it's because Jack Kirby on one day was drawing the flying car, and he thought that oval shape would be really, really cool to draw. No. And then there's an aerodynamic pocket field. No, it's Jack. Listen to me. You're not listening.
See, I put a lot of this down to... I'm convinced that a lot of this began because of Frank Miller, Dark Knight Returns. Because there's that wonderful scene in, I think, the very first issue, or if not, maybe the second issue of that, where he's on the tightrope. And gets shot and reveals that underneath the bat symbol is body armor. And in the captions, he says, "Why do you think I wear a target on my chest? I can't armor my head." And I think for readers of a certain teenage, that was kind of like, whoa, it was one of those mind blown moments, you know? And I really think that that has a lot to answer for. That seemed to begin the spate of trying to explain things like that and sort of coming up with cool, realistic reasons for why superhero things were the way they are.
It can enhance things. Like, well, I like that bit. I also like the bit about the cape, because he Frank Miller has him exploiting a lot of stagecraft. That's like, he's jumping down, but now he's crouching down so that people think that his body is still extended. And now they're shooting through the cape, but they think that, oh my God, the slugs went right through his body. And
can't shoot him.
He can't be human. He's this specter. He is this ghost. And we're scared out of our wits now. And that they'll put them at a disadvantage. The great thing is, it just doesn't feel like it's belabored. It feels like a natural extension. And also,
so I think the lesson here is, it's all right when Frank Miller does it. I wonder how many listeners are old enough to get the Basil Exposition joke. I got it.
Are we now so old that we can't make references from the late 1990s that anybody will get?